Okay, we are continuing our study of the book of the 12, that is the minor prophets. We'll begin the book of Habakkuk tonight. As we look back where we've been, we started with the book of Jonah, and we were seeking to work through chronologically to the best of our knowledge and ability that way. So we started with Jonah, kind of a unique one of the minor prophets, a story as well as a prophecy. That is Jonah, some of the most information about one of the prophets given in that one. And then moves to kind of a pair of prophets against that had an oracles against the northern kingdom of Israel. That is Hosea and Amos. And they were condemning the leadership in the northern kingdom of Israel before Assyria came through. Then we had Micah, and he was to really address to both. He was the most sort of Judah-centric prophet to this point. So while he did address the northern kingdom before it had fallen, the northern kingdom was about to fall, and so he focused on the southern kingdom. Then we were just in Nahum. Nahum also focused on the southern kingdom and as it related to the judgment of Nineveh. So a word of comfort to an oppressed people, and that word of comfort is the fall of the oppressor, namely the northern kingdom of Assyria. So the distinctive about Habakkuk tonight, he's still in this a similar period of time. So we've moved in our timeline to, I should have drawn these as we went here, but we're right about in this period. So the northern kingdom has already fallen to Assyria. This marker here is when Babylon comes through and attacks and brings down the southern kingdom in the exile, period of exile. So we have this prophet, that is Habakkuk, and then Zephaniah. Those two land right in this period. It maybe Manasseh, which we'll talk about him for a moment. He was a very evil, wicked king. He's probably the king that was reigning when Habakkuk is prophesying. So Manasseh and then Josiah, which was during Zephaniah, the next prophet that we'll look at. He was prophesying during Josiah's reign, probably early in Josiah. But those two, Habakkuk and Zephaniah, are together as this pair of prophets right before the exile, right before Babylon comes through. So they really are shifting their attention from Assyria now to the promised rise of Babylon that was going to come after Assyria. So we ask the question by way of introduction as far as Habakkuk, what do we know about him? We normally look at the beginning of the book, and chapter 1, verse 1 says, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. We don't have a city or a location that he came from. We don't have him mentioned other places in Scripture. There's only one other time in the book that he is mentioned. That's chapter 3, verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. And so this is, we don't really know anything about him, aside from that he was the prophet. And we get a little bit of his personality or things like that, but we don't know much about him. He's almost certainly from somewhere in Judah, because the northern kingdom at this point has been brought low by Assyria, so he's probably not from there. And his realm of observation, what he's interacting with, is that he looked around him and saw the things that were going wrong in Judah. So that's probably where he's from generally, but we don't know much more aside from that. That also answers our question of who this is addressed to. It's addressed to the southern kingdom of Judah, against which Babylon, or as the Chaldeans in chapter 1, verse 6, are going to march against. So it's going to be the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of Judah. So that's who he's addressing this oracle to. So let's look a little bit in the book of Kings. We're going to look at chapter 20, 2 Kings 20. So in order to place this chronologically, we know that this prophet would have been prophesying before the Babylonian invasion of Judah. And that kind of began in 605 BC through in the 580s. So 605 to 580 is when Babylon is really hard pressing and drawing Judah into exile. So if you go a little bit older than that, 612 is when Nineveh falls. So that was what Nahum was speaking about a little bit. But this has got to be before the Babylonian invasion of Judah. It also makes sense that this is before the Babylonian rise against Assyria, because what God tells Habakkuk in his first question that we'll look at in a moment, like, what are you going to do about this injustice? Well, he describes to him Babylon. He describes to him that he's going to raise up this nation. He describes it in a way that would come as quite a surprise to Habakkuk. So this is probably still prior to the rise of Babylon, even in their tearing down of Nineveh. So our few options as far as what kings then he would be prophesying during are Manasseh, and I probably favor that one. Manasseh reigned from 686 BC down to 642, so still prior to the fall of Nineveh. But then what's telling is that the next king after Manasseh was shortly after, was Josiah, which was Manasseh's grandson. And Josiah led a period of reform. He actually turned the hearts of Judah in such a way that God granted like an extension on their life, right? He allowed them to exist for a little bit longer because of Josiah's uprightness. So it doesn't seem then that these prophets who bring these scathing words against Judah are probably during the height of Josiah's reign. It would be prior to that. So Josiah reigned from 640 to 609. So it's at the end of Josiah's reign that Nineveh fell. So that's going to place both Habakkuk and then Zephaniah late in Manasseh's reign, where they're seeing all this, and we'll describe some of what's happening during Manasseh, or early, very early in Josiah's reign, before a lot of these reforms have begun to take place. So 2 Kings chapter 20. I'm going to read this interesting account of what led into Manasseh and then through chapter 21. So chapter 20, verse 12, at that time, this is the king before Manasseh, at that time, Berodach Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah was attentive to them and showed them all the house of his treasures, silver and gold, the spices and precious ointment, and all his armory, all that was found among his treasures. There was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, "What did these men say, and from where did they come to you?" So Hezekiah said, "They came from a far country, from Babylon." He obviously isn't viewing them as a threat to this point. And he said, "What have they seen in your house? What all did you show them?" And Hezekiah answered, "They've seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them." And then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." So Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of the Lord which you have spoken is good, for Isaiah had said, 'Will there not be peace and truth, at least in my days?'" Okay, so there's been a little bit of interaction prior to, not very wise interaction on Hezekiah's part, showing, whining and dining this envoy from Babylon, and showing them everything that you can do, showing them all of your technology and all of your military and all of your treasures, like, this is what we have. Well, it's not going to be long, too long, before Babylon then comes against Jerusalem and against the king. Okay, so following the end of chapter 20 is Hezekiah's death, and Manasseh, his son, reigns in his place. So who was Manasseh? Why are Habakkuk and Zephaniah so furious about what's happening in Judah? Well, it's about as dark as it ever got in Judah during Manasseh's reign. Let's read chapter 21. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, very long time as these kings lived. His mother's name was Hephzibah, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places, which Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. He raised up altars for Baal. He made a wooden image, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. So he's patterning after Ahab's religion. And he worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem I will put my name." And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Also he made his son pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, and consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of which the Lord had said to David and to Solomon his son, "In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will not make the feet of Israel wander any more from the land which I gave to their fathers. Only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them." But they paid no attention. And Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spoke by his servants the prophets, saying, "Because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, he has acted more wickedly than all the Amorites who were before him, and has also made Judah sin with his idols. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such calamity upon Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle, and I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it, turning it upside down. So I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies. And they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies because they have done evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides his sin by which he made Judah sin in doing evil in the sight of the Lord. Now the rest of the acts of Manasseh, all that are did, the sins that he committed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Manasseh rested with his fathers and was buried in the garden of his own house, in the garden of Uzzah. Then his son Amon reigned in his place. Amon reigns for 2 years, and then his son Josiah takes his place. So it's the darkest period in Judah's history. It is as dark as it gets, more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. All of these pagan worshipers, Judah looked worse. They had assimilated all of the idols of all the peoples, and they were setting up altars to each and every one of them, creating gods, even taking them into the very house of the Lord and worshiping them there. So the sacrilege is, and just the blasphemy is at an all-time high. Seems that that would be an appropriate time for this message of Habakkuk to arrive. So it's probably, as we've said, during Manasseh's reign, or perhaps the Amon and the early part of Josiah's reign, there would have been a lot of reverberations from this false worship that had continued. So Habakkuk is observing all of these things. He's seeing the wickedness and the evil. And Habakkuk is still a short book. It's about three chapters for us. Habakkuk writes a lament over Judah as he sees the corruption and the violence, the Hamas is one of the key words in the book. Most of the time, as we've seen, the prophets receive a word from the Lord that they bring to the people. One of the distinctive things about Habakkuk is that it is the way that the oracles are given to us are in a question and answer setting. So Habakkuk's actually bringing a question to God based upon his observations. So There's a bit of the sage aspect, that he's seen some things going on in the world. He knows it's unwise. He knows it's wicked. And so it begins basically with prayers, his prayers, asking questions to God. There's two main questions that he asks. So chapter 1, 1 through 4 is the first question that God answers. And then Habakkuk responds with a second question. God answers. And then chapter 3 is distinct from the first two, and it's a psalm. It's Habakkuk's psalm, a song of faith in response to what God has said in answering his questions. And it's a psalm of resolve that he will wait, that he will trust, that he will believe that God will bring solutions, even though they seem quite confusing and odd to Habakkuk, the solutions that God has described he's going to bring. So the book reads a lot like kind of an extended lament psalm, as Habakkuk's mourning how far Judah has fallen from the covenantal standards that they had agreed to. So he's yearning for salvation, he's yearning for deliverance. That's one of the themes in chapter 3. And he talks to God about the darkness that's engulfing Judah, and looks really for a faithful way forward. How do I live in the middle of this? So the first question, and we'll read through this in a moment, but the first question is really asking, how long do I need to wait for your salvation? I'm looking around me. All I see is evil. All I see is that the wicked are winning. We've seen some other psalms sort of like that from David, right? The wicked are winning. Why are they winning? How long do I have to wait for your deliverance? And God responds, his answer in the next portion of chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, is that justice is on the way. Don't you worry. Like, I'm bringing justice. The shocking part to Habakkuk is that he's bringing justice by means of an evil people. He's bringing justice by means of the Chaldeans. God's kind of like, his response is, well, watch this. Watch what I'm going to do with this perverse empire. And Habakkuk responds then with his second question in chapter 1, 12 through the beginning of chapter 2. He says, is that really justice? Like, that seems like a shocking reply to my initial complaint. Yet, I will wait for a response. It's kind of the beginning of chapter 2. I'll just wait because there may be some things I don't know, but this seems like a very hunter-hunted sort of way to respond to my question. So then God does respond, and he says, well, my justice it will be thorough. So it's not just going to be justice on Judah. I will then bring justice against the Chaldeans, against Babylon. And so most of chapter 2 is God's response to describing that it is going to be the righteous people that live, is going to be those who walk by faith. Those are the ones that live. And to this instrument of justice that I brought, that is an evil instrument, he brings a series of five woe songs against them. So that's chapter 2, starting in the middle of verse 6, you'll see the first woe, and verse 9 is the second, 12 is the third, 15 is the fourth, and then in the middle of, or at the beginning of 19 is the fifth. So there's five woe series against them that are brought. To which then Habakkuk responds with this psalm. He writes in response to God's destruction of Babylon. And he starts in chapter 3, 2. O Lord, I've heard your speech, and I was afraid. O Lord, revive the work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And so he actually responds in this kind of this description, reflecting on a few things. The salvation of God in Israel's history. He goes back, as they often do in the Old Testament, to recount the faithful works of God. These moments of reflection kind of include the gamut of God's interaction with them, from Exodus to Sinai and to the conquest in Canaan, to a lot of different very significant moments. And God is displayed through this psalm as a great and a terrible warrior. someone who brings righteous judgment to pierce these very deep moments of darkness. And each one of those moments, whether it's Sinai or the conquest or back to Exodus, each one of them, he describes God's work in interaction or being grounded in his covenant, being grounded in God's promise. That's why he did what he did, because he is committed to his people. So his loving kindness. So deliverance then is not a happenstance or just this faint longing that Habakkuk holds to with a distant hope. It's not like that. Right? As he looks back, he says, no, hope is something that we can absolutely have no matter what's happening because of your commitment to your people. So it's the covenant that then functions to kind of anchor Habakkuk's soul as he clings to it. What is a deep hope? Well, the covenant is a deep hope because God promises to keep that. And accumulates at the very end with verses 17 through 19 with a very specific, beautiful rise. Basically, though everything else is going wrong, and these are probably, maybe aside from chapter 2, verse 4, the most common verses or the most well-known verses in Habakkuk. Though the fig tree doesn't blossom, and even if fruit's not on the vines, or the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on high hills. So he ends, quite literally, in a very high note. It's like that this is not, again, grasping at hope. It's something that we can hold quite securely. It's not a far-fetched thing. So that's kind of the structure. That's the movement throughout the books. And so it's simple and it's short. It's one that kind of, some of these prophets are very difficult to kind of organize or outline. There's a lot of blending, but this one's quite crisp and clear. Two series of questions and then a psalm at the end. So that's kind of nice for a break, to have a very clear outline. So we're going to go ahead and we'll read through Habakkuk, probably be about 10 minutes, and then we'll just open it up as we read through this. If there are things that as we walk through Habakkuk that you are like, I really am curious about that, or perhaps you see things rise as themes, or maybe you see a verse you're like, hey, I think I've seen that in the New Testament. We'll kind of open it up to a discussion of those few things afterwards, and then we'll close in our introduction of Habakkuk. So follow along as I read God's word. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1 says, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence, Hamas, and you will not save. And why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds. So God responds, look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you. For indeed, I am raising up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, a bitter and a hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for Hamas, for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing this power to his God. Habakkuk replies, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment. O Rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with a hook. They catch them up in their net. They gather them in their dragnet. Therefore, they rejoice and they're glad. Therefore, they sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their dragnet, because by them their share is sumptuous and their food plentiful. Shall they therefore empty their net and continue to slay nations without pity? I will stand my watch and I'll set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he, the Lord, will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. Then the Lord answered me. And he said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end, it will speak and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Behold, the proud. His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man. And he does not stay at home, because he enlarges his desire as hell, and he is like death and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations and heaps up for himself all peoples. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his, how long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you, and you will become their booty? Because you have plundered many nations, and the remnant of the people, or all the remnant of the people, shall plunder you because of men's blood. And the Hamas of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples, and sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire and the nations weary themselves in vain? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. For the Hamas done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the Hamas of the land and the city, and of all who dwell in it. What profit is the image that its maker should carve it. The molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard your speech and I was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years to make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. He had rays flashing from his hand, and there his power was hidden. Before him went pestilence, and fever followed at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and startled the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills bowed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian trembled. O Lord, were you displeased with the rivers? Was your anger against the rivers? Was your wrath against the sea? That you rode on your horses, your chariots of salvation, your bow was made quite ready, oaths were sworn over your arrows, Selah. You divided the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered its voice and lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of your arrows they went. At the shining of your glittering spear, you marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people. For salvation with your Mashiach, your anointed. You struck the head from the house of the wicked. By laying bare from foundation to neck, Selah. You thrust through with his own arrows the head of his villages. They came out like a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was like feasting on the poor in secret. You walked through the sea with your horses, through the heap of great waters. When I heard, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops. Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk up on my high hills, to the chief musician with the stringed instruments. Okay, let's talk about this for a few moments, maybe done a little bit early tonight. First, we'll just ask, are the theological themes, what comes up kind of consistently throughout this book from a zoomed out perspective, what is Habakkuk addressing? It's not necessarily new or distinct from many of the other prophets, but what is he addressing? Violence. in a variety of different ways. And we'll talk about that word Hamas a little bit more. It's obviously taken some new meaning for us since this time. But yeah, the word violence is used, I think, five or six times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think 5 times throughout in three chapters. And it begins with Habakkuk's problem. That's what he sees. He sees Hamas. And then God raises up a people of Hamas, a people of violence, in order to be his instrument of righteousness. And then because of their violence and their bloodshed and the fact that they've broken his law with all this violence, that's why he brings against them the woe oracles. So yeah, he weaves it all together in a couple different ways. So yeah, violence is absolutely one of the themes. And what God, maybe how God uses it, what he thinks about it, how he responds to it, in a variety of ways. So. Yeah. He has the last word. So his strength, maybe, is one of those things. Similarly to Nahum, as we looked at last time, the question naturally follows God saying, well, I'm going to bring down Nineveh, is can you bring down Nineveh? And that's very true in this too. He's demonstrating his strength not only by bringing down Babylon in chapter 2, but by raising it up in chapter 1. He is the one that, you know, does both of those things. So yeah, it speaks to the supremacy of his authority and power. Which speaks of his sovereignty, absolutely. Along with the strength, he uses creation again too, especially in the psalm, which is normal in a psalm, very poetic language. As he looks back and you see the rivers and the waters and all these things that God kind of uses. That's how Habakkuk describes, you know, his horses are like running through this river and things, so. Yeah, God hears. And that is one of the distinctive points of Habakkuk, is the interaction between the two. Prayer, answer. Still in very prophetic form, right? He receives an oracle. He sees something dramatic, perhaps a vision or a response from God, that he then communicates to the people. But it is God responding to a specific question. Yeah. Yep. Which we'll talk about this a little bit more next week, but isn't it interesting just coming from Genesis into Habakkuk that's Abram's origin story, right? He was brought out of paganism. Okay, other theological themes or thoughts here? I don't know how to say it in a word. The surety of the promise is quite a big one. The reason for the entirety of chapter 3 is God reiterating that he's going to do what he said he will do. And his response to the second question, so chapter 2, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it, for the vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end, it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it. So there's just a really strong encouragement from Habakkuk to, again, the surety of his hope, that it's as good as done, even if you never live to see it. It's done. Like, count on it, because God said it. So the surety of God's promise, which Habakkuk does respond to. That's where he says, well, even if I never see it, I know that this is the God of my salvation. I know he's the one who promises deliverance. Yeah, man.
Verse 2:14 seems to me to be like a major theme.
Yep.
It's explicit there, but it's implicit everywhere else that
Mm-hmm. So it's a theme really in the middle of the book, doing the woes particularly. So the glory of God is going to be like the water in the ocean, right? As much as water covers the ocean, so God's glory will cover the world. And then he, in the next woe oracle, so 16, verse 16 is the middle of it. He says, "You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink," because they're getting these people drunk, right? There is what Babylon's accused of in order to expose their nakedness. And now God turns at them and says, "You drink. I'm going to make you drunk and expose you for," interesting to pair this with last week, "your uncircumcision," right? The fact that you have not been changed. You're not mine. "The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory." So he's contrasting the two, the glory of Babylon, which God built them up to be mighty, right? And to see how they abuse that using violence, Hamas. And God's response then is to give them, to heap them with shame and glorify himself. See how they begin working with each other, right?
The relevance of this and what's going on in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his very first line, "How long, O Lord?"
Yeah.
I feel like that every day.
Right.
This world is just insane. It's crazy. It's violent. It's perverse. But I'm like, how long, Lord, are you going to put up with this?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. But it also, at the same time, like you said, gives us the hope that though all this stuff is, as he finishes up, everything, if we agree with the olive oil, I'll still rejoice.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Sort of following up what Eric says, though, the funny thing about, well, funny is not the right word. The interesting thing about this text is, I agree, like, how long do you're going to right the wrongs, all the injustices around me, all that stuff? And the answer would be like God saying, "Oh yeah, don't worry. Vladimir Putin will soon invade America and enslave you all."
Right.
Oh wait.
Hold up.
Never mind.
That's not what I meant. Are you sure? Yeah, I mean, you're from everlasting, oh Lord my God, my Holy One. Right, but that seems is violence the answer? Is kind of his response. That the, a lot of imagery of the fisherman in 15 through 17. Then he just empties his net to go get another load. And he's worshiping his net, right? Because his net is providing for him. Those guys? Okay, any that you noticed from the New Testament quotations? Any of those? There's a couple. I'm sure probably more even than... I didn't have time to do a thorough dig, but I know two at least. Yeah, there you go. So Paul uses that in his argument in Galatians. Galatians 3. He says... Oh, I'm in Ephesians. I'm like, that doesn't look right. So Ephesians 3, "For as many as are the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them,'" which is Deuteronomy. "But that no one is justified by the law in the sight of God is evident, for," Habakkuk said, "the just shall live by faith. Yet the law is not of faith, but the man who does them shall live by them." So it's kind of interesting, even as you think about law and grace here in Galatians 3. And those are one of the main things that Habakkuk brings out at the beginning is that the law is powerless. The law is not working because people aren't obeying it. Right? You have perverse leaders who are misappropriating the law. Therefore, it doesn't do anything. And Paul's like, right. And if you're trusting it for righteousness, that's not going to, it won't do, right? And he argues even that Habakkuk is making the argument that it is faith whereby we live. So, yeah, that's probably the most common one. And then the other one, I'm trying to, I know it's in Acts 13, but it's, they'll just shall live by faith. Yeah. Yep.
So I was thinking Romans too. But
it's the same argument.
So yeah, but I'm sorry, Romans.
Go ahead.
I'm pretty convinced that Romans is a theological treatise
on
Habakkuk.
Yeah.
Too. Like it's the Paul's whole argument is centered on that phrase for the whole book of Romans, the just shall live by faith. Way beyond the scope of Habakkuk. So.
Right. No, that's part of what we're doing tonight, though. So in Acts 13, so he quotes Habakkuk 1:5, which is the beginning of God's response, the working a wonder that they wouldn't believe. So in Acts 13, so Barnabas and Paul have just been appointed. And they're at Antioch, and in the middle of their sermon, so verse 36, for David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell asleep, was buried with his fathers, and saw corruption. But he whom God raised up saw no corruption. Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through this man, that through this man is preached to you the forgiveness of sins. And by him, everyone who believes is justified from all things from which you could not be justified by the law of Moses. Beware, therefore, lest what has been spoken in the prophets come upon you. Behold, you despisers, marvel and perish, for I work a work in your days, a work which you will by no means believe, though one were to declare it to you. So he's saying, beware lest you be Babylon, right? Lest you be perhaps an instrument of wrath, right? Believe on Christ, because forgiveness is through him. And thereby you escape the woe to the Babylonians. So yeah, there's a couple different significant places. I'm sure there's probably more as well. Perhaps we'll discover those along the way. Any questions that you want to kind of put on the list as we go through? They're like, make sure we touch on this.
So this is a question. It's back to the just shall live by faith. It's also quoted in Hebrews, and in studying this, I ran across a commentator that suggested that the treatise of Romans dwells on the idea of the just. Who is the just? How can you be just? Etc. The treatise in Galatians emphasizes how then should you live. Well, you don't live like Peter was. He said he believed in the justifying work of Christ, but he lived in a manner that suggested that the law would somehow save. And then the passage in Hebrews, the treatise of Hebrews, emphasized the matter of faith. And it just blows me away to think that this little phrase mm-hmm. in this obscure prophet is expanded on in the New Testament in three of the most significant portions for us. Mm-hmm. And isn't it?
Yeah, that is beautiful. Crazy, I'm sure that. The list of dissertations written on Paul's use or the author of Hebrews' use of Habakkuk, I'm sure there's a wealth of information there to dive into as well. Yeah, it is beautiful. It's a statement almost that you could just kind of walk through Habakkuk and maybe even miss it. And Jesus, as he accused Nicodemus, might say, wait, are you a teacher of these things and you don't know? He said the just shall live by faith. You know, and then just to see that expounded after the life of Christ. It is beautiful. Yeah.
In chapter 2, in that woe section where there's the five woes there, it seems kind of generic. It doesn't seem like he is addressing Babylon directly. I mean, it doesn't say that, does it?
Babylon, the name is not mentioned.
Included in this, but it could be all those things could be directed at the Jews in Judea.
That's part of what Paul seems to be doing in Acts, is to say, well, repent and believe, lest you become included in the woes against Babylon. So I think that's true. I mean, Habakkuk, I do believe he's talking about Babylon, particularly in the bloodshed. Accusations because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and those who dwell in it, and that's a repeated theme throughout there. So contextually, he's talking about Babylon, but I think just as what we discovered in Nahum, like this is a pattern. Like there, Babylon is bigger than Babylon, Assyria is bigger than Assyria. They're representative of the whole, I think.
I think, so when I say Habakkuk before, the reason why commentators say that second part is about Babylon is because that's the question that Habakkuk poses.
But you could even argue that the question he's responding is general too. Like, is that the right way to handle evil? Seems weird, you know, to respond to evil with more evil. Like, that could be a very general question. I think it is specific. Like, that's what I'm saying. Habakkuk's writing about this, but they are principled.
And God does say that he's going to judge. He specifically says in chapter 1, he's going to judge Babylon.
He's raising up.
He's going to use Babylon to judge Judah. And so you might surmise from that the chapter 2 is talking about Babylon.
Certainly. Yeah, it is. Yeah. He's responding in his second question. He's responding to the answer of the first. He's like, why would you? So like verse 13, the second part. Why do you hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Like there, he's describing Babylon devouring Judah. Like that's the one devouring the person more righteous than he. So I think it is. You make probably pretty strong arguments that's the flow of thought. It's still related to Babylon. But then how do we address Babylon and Habakkuk? I think similarly to the way we addressed Assyria and Nahum, that it is that they're bigger than those empires. Yeah.
The biblical principle of he who rolls the stone will have a roll back on him. So these guys that are
Yeah, and that was true. So if we look back in Nahum 2:2, the emptiers and the ruiners then get emptied. Right? She is empty, desolate, and waste. Here, those who are causing other people to drink and press them to nakedness, they are forced to drink and are exposed. So it is very much like that. In fact, we'll talk about the law of retribution. Like it is very eye for eye sort of. A way of handling that. Okay. Okay, so just so that everyone knows, next week is the first week of Pastor Matt and I's Elder Refresh. So Brother Lloyd Larkin is going to be here, and he's going to lead the Bible study next week. Following that, Pastor Matt is going to lead for a week. Probably something more in relation, probably a theology proper topic that's in relation to the Genesis 17 and 18. And then we'll pick back up. So it'll be 3 weeks from today that we're back in Habakkuk. And we'll probably be here for 2 or 3 weeks studying these. So that's kind of the plan for the next few weeks. We'll go ahead and close this evening in a word of prayer.